G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
And as I welcome Adam White to the program, we need to congratulate him for John McNamara of Gornong, because Whitey won the face-off on Friday morning, picking Jack Lukosius with the most kicks. And if Carlton are going to have 28 points on the scoreboard, Jack Lukosius is going to bring the ball in a few more times than anyone else. And he comfortably won the kicks on the Friday face-off. So a good start to the weekend it was for our one and only Adam White. Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. Yes, it was good. 8 tips out of 8 is even better.
Oh, you are hot to trot.
Not reflected in my betting account, but anyway, you can't have everything. Good morning.
I'm
a bit tired this morning.
Hang on, it's Monday morning. What's happened? Why are you tired?
Well, I stayed up too late watching Minjee Lee. I thought she was going to win. Genuinely thought she was going to win. Where was that golf tournament being played again, Daniel?
Royal Trin.
That's right. That's where it was.
That's right.
And I just thought that the woman that won the event,
Sophia Popov.
She sort of was almost like a wire-to-wire type victory. She is ranked 300 in the world and had never won a professional golf tournament, and she went on to hold her nerve to win the Open Championship, the Women's Open Championship. So it was a remarkable effort because, usually in that situation they don't hold on to win and they show nerves and they combust on the back nine on Sunday, and she didn't. So Minjee Lee, unfortunately, she finished inside the top three. Didn't do a lot wrong, but unfortunately on the weekend the butts didn't fall, and she fell just short of winning her first major championship.
Is inside the top three third?
I just can't remember whether it was second or third. I think it was third. Yes, so no, that's why I said inside the top three. So yes, that's correct.
She did finish third. 4 shots behind the eventual winner, Sophia Popov, Alexander Popov's sister. Jasmine Sawanapura. Thailand's Jasmine Sawanapura finished in second spot in the Women's Open there at Royal Trin. So Minjee missed out. Good performance. Top three is always a good thing. And she's in pretty good form at the moment too, but not quite to be her maiden major victory. But well done, Sophia. That is a bloody good effort, that is. Mm. Speaking of combusting, Adam Ramanauskas might have done that, watching Dreamtime at Darwin on Saturday night, because he's a great Bombers champion, premiership player with the Mighty Bombers, and these days manager to the Stars. And he joins us on the Monday morning on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Rama.
Very good morning. It was an interesting Saturday night watching the Dreamtime game, but Essendon probably simply weren't good enough to win anyway, regardless of what's occurred after the event, with a couple of fines to a few of those Richmond players. But well, I'm sure we'll talk about that plenty later. But I would like an investigation into the face-off on Friday.
Yes, good point.
I'm just not sure that Whitey can be winning with, you know, a guy kicking the ball out from full back at least 15 times. 15 of his kicks are from full back.
Yes.
I'm just not that comfortable with it.
It did sour a wonderful competition, the Friday face-off, and taken all before it. And there's people talking about it all across the globe these days because the rsn.net.au has hit live streaming opportunity and the app, of course. And I'm getting messages, I'm getting DMs on the interweb from people who are saying, this is a farce, this is a disgrace, you can't have this go on. It's making a mockery of a world-famous competition. So I think that you got merit in this conversation, Rama. You've got merit.
And what concerns me is the man that won on Friday night then has the cheek to, you know, just to send a little cheeky text message before he goes to bed. Just to really rub it in.
It's a lovely way to finish a week, is to get the face-off victory. I mean, at the end of the day, Boomer was the one that selected kicks. Yes. And I think he actually set it up thinking that we weren't smart enough to go with Lukosius because he had the last selection. And, it is what it is. I wouldn't have selected kicks because I agree with you. I think that's, it opens it up for some, not manipulation, but, it's not a meaningful sort of thing when you have a guy kicking in from full back.
Kentucky's next week for sure.
I was just thinking that, Rama.
Well, it's my choice. It's a big game next Friday night too. We shouldn't be looking necessarily ahead to next Friday night already, but I'm looking forward to it. I think it's Geelong and the Bulldogs.
Come on, I'll look at that. Thursday. Well, we've got Thursday night. Friday night is, yeah, Geelong and the Bulldogs. There you go.
And Thursday night is Essendon Hawthorn, I believe. Is that right?
Correct. And Richmond West Coast. Oh. That's a good night of footy. Anyway, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves.
Yes. Well, let's head back a little bit because I had a disappointment on Saturday.
Huh? What happened?
Well, when the races got called off on at the Valley, before the start of the quaddie, also got called off was my five timeser.
Of course.
And my five timeser come right into about $2.90.
Oh, Rammer, I forgot about that. So you had an investment on Dino's Rammer Ruffy, which was whatever it was, because I forgot about it too after it was cancelled. And you got the five times multiplier on the Tab app for the first time ever. And the races were scratched. See, this is what they'll go to. These are the lengths they'll go to. Mm. My understanding is Quinny was seen with a hose at Moonee Valley on the bends, just making big puddles so that they wouldn't have to pay out your five timeser on the multiplier.
Yes, it was. Yeah, when the information came through on the World Wide Web, there was one disappointed man.
Oh, what a disappointment! I'd forgotten about that, Rama.
So the races get called off. You obviously get your money back for your bet. Me stupidly thinking, look, the TAB, they're very generous. I'll put my next bet on and, you know, something quite nice, and I'll get the five times or again. 1.02.
the elusive five times, it's like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. They talk about it, but you've never actually seen it. And you've got it. And they cancel the whole bloody meeting on you.
Yeah.
I feel for you, Raman. That's not right. That's not right. There should be able to be a carryover champ situation.
Yeah.
And you get to have that. Oh, goodness gracious me. That is disappointing. Very disappointing. Do you know what I did Saturday? Now, digressing from the water sport for a second. I was a delivery boy on Saturday. And it's a little bit of a plug for my cafe. It's Maple Jones in Greensboro. So what would do, because you can't go to the cafes anymore, a lot of cafes out there are doing order and online and will deliver to you. So I became delivery boy on Saturday. And my first delivery was out near Whitey's joint at Templestowe. And it was a gift from somebody rang in because someone was moving into a new house. It was a housewarming gift. So I've taken this stuff to the housewarming gift. And you know when they talk about the flower deliverer, is being a flower delivery person is one of the great jobs in the world because you just bring in joy and you're giving gifts to people that not necessarily know they're going to get gifts. This housewarming present, nobody knew it was coming. And I got there, and they're looking at me as I knocked on the door, who the hell's this bloke? And I explained the situation, you've been given a gift from whoever it was, and yada yada, happy housewarming. And I got a few details from the orderer about the house and how long they'd been there and where they'd come from. So we had a bit of a conversation about that. And all the family came out. Mum was there at the door initially, and then Dad comes because they needed two sets of hands to carry all the stuff. And then the kids come out, and they are overjoyed with the delivery, and somebody's thought about giving them this. It was a breakfast box, basically, a couple of breakfast boxes. Somebody's thought about giving them this gift as a housewarming present. And there was a lot of joy, Rama. You would have loved it, because there was so much happiness and thankfulness and gratitude for the effort of someone to consider them through this time. And I was the one getting the love. Not the person who'd made the order. It was the delivery guy who was getting the love, Rama. It's a very good job being a delivery guy when you're doing that stuff. It was magnificent start to the weekend.
It's amazing how all those little things now that people just appreciate so much more. You know, it's just a little, well, probably a big in your case with your cafe, a big breakfast box.
It's a good box.
Because we're not seeing people as regularly as we are, we're seeing people over Zoom or FaceTime or however you're communicating with people. But I run to the door when the postman comes now, just to say hello to him. Just the human interaction.
And they drop and go pretty quick these days too. They're not keen to hang around.
Yeah, No, they're gone. But it's a good thing.
The bonus for this family, of course, is that a game changer has knocked on the door. A very famous person.
They wouldn't have known.
A bringing together of people.
Contact free.
Did they know who you were?
No idea. The beanie, I had a beanie knitted by the great Joey Pignataro. I had the face mask on. And they were. I basically could have been anyone. I had no idea, which was great. But it was great. We had a great conversation, and they loved it. So I suggest, if you can, write a letter to someone, or if someone's feeling down at the moment, send them something in the mail, because they'll love it, the fact that you've considered them and thought about them throughout this time. I reckon you're right, Rammer. It's been heightened by what's happening, but the joy and the gratitude was quite emotional, actually. It was fantastic.
Just with the beanie from Joey, did you put a wig on and leave the your fringe out the front of the beanie?
No. No, that's a Joey special, that is. Well, it's a bit difficult with my fringe.
I have a suspicion, Rammer, that it was more a disguise type setup so people didn't know who he was. He was a bit worried about just the adulation, and probably would have been, invited in for a cuppa and just some life skills and all that sort of stuff,
Contactless delivery.
How many deliveries did you attend to on Saturday?
Probably about 15.
Lovely.
Yeah, it was good. It was good fun. Normally people just order and you deliver their food, so they know it's coming, so it's a bit of a different scenario. But the gift delivery is a very, very nice thing. That's a good job, a gift delivery. You get a lot of love for not doing much.
Do you put in like a bonus sort of 2019 AFLW Grand Final DVD type setup in the hamper and all that sort of stuff?
I did sneak in a few old footy cards.
Hang on. Why would you put the 2019 Grand Final DVD in there?
Well, it's one of the great things.
Just for the start. Just, the national anthem and, have it, just being on the big stage, that sort of thing,
Is that the game that he didn't tag the best player in the AFLW competition?
I stood there arm in arm. I stood there, remember? Arm in arm very well at the start.
That's the only good thing you did that day.
Shut up, mate. Bottom to top, mate. Bottom to top. That's all you need to know. I'll tell you what, you could use me in the bomber land at the moment. I'd sort a few things out. That's what I'd do.
Yeah, it was. That was a funny game on Saturday night.
Not really.
And again, we'll talk about it. You could see what Essendon were trying to do. What? You could see
can you enlighten me, Ben Rutten.
Well, they were basically just folding back numbers to clog up space in Richmond's defence. But then as soon as they won back the ball in defence, they just seemed to kick it back to Richmond's defenders, and who just then jammed the ball back inside forward 50. And that continued to happen all night. And then it came to a climax with Nick Vlosten and Tom Bell Chambers, and Nick Vlosten getting fined for staging and basically kicking the match ceiling goal.
They're not going to win. They weren't going to win anyway.
I didn't say they were going to win. I just said it was the match-winning goal.
He did say that.
Yeah, that. Do you think Essendon knows that Dustin Martin's a really good player?
I'm not sure.
Because they never put anyone anywhere near Dustin Martin, ever.
Essendon have Essendon have a tendency, when a player's really good, to make him look even better again. Because Essendon don't tag. Like, you've got Dylan Clark there, who's come into the side over the last couple of weeks. Last year, he came in and tagged on a few occasions and did a really, really good job. Now, at the moment, he's playing half forward, half back, wherever he's playing. Just whack him on one of their good players. When Martin was going well, he plays on Martin. When Shea Bolton's going well, as he did on Saturday night, whack him on Shea Bolton. But anyway, it's the system-based football.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really matter. It's very interesting. You let the best player in the competition just roam free, particularly at stoppage, I wonder. Oh, I don't know that system, how that works, that one. Let's let him go at the stoppage where he's got all this space to move.
But it happens every time Essendon plays Richmond. It was 66 inside 50s to 24.
Yeah. It's only 42
66
difference.
Insides to 24. Now, ultimately, the difference was 12 points for Rammer, and it was 23 scoring shots to 11. But late goals from Essendon. Yeah, I mean, Richmond White was not going to lose that game.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Whitey, but 66 may be the most this season. by any team.
It's a big number. I mean, that's a good number in a full game.
Yeah, why? Absolutely. It has to be close, Raymond. It has to be close.
Yeah.
We'll get that confirmed. Joey will find out.
What I will say is the game in Darwin, the Dreamtime game in Darwin, that worked.
Yes.
The scenes that we saw before the game, you know, the joy in the crowd, that we the images that kept coming through, it just worked. It worked really well. And I think, you know, there has to be some sort of consideration. Now, I know that's a big ticket item for the MCG and the AFL, the Dreamtime at the G, but that worked on Saturday night.
No doubt about that. The whole look, Remy, you're right. The pre-game, the build-up, the welcome to country is the best welcome to country we've ever seen in the history of mankind. There's some really good energy in that. Love that. And then, of course, the game up there and the way it was received by the fans and the opportunity for all the Northern Territorians to visit and be a part of that moment, the celebration of their culture, of their history, I think it was a magic moment. I don't know how they do it, Ramon, because I think it's $1 million sort of game for clubs down here. Richmond and Essendon down here when it is at the G in front of 80,000 or 90,000. And in these times where every dollar is pretty hard to come by and going forward they're going to be pretty handy, I don't know how you'd make it a financially viable option. And in the end, it's all going to come down to finances, we know, in the current climate in footy and sport or in business in Australia. But I agree with you. Sentimentally, I think it's a fabulous idea to lock it in as a Northern Territory product, as a TIO Stadium product.
It just felt like the game belonged to Darwin, the fans in Darwin. It just felt like it was their game. You know, you could see how proud they were of the game being there, and you know the colours in the crowd, all Richmond, all Essendon jumpers everywhere, and it just felt like it was their game. It belonged to them.
I agree. It's a wonderful thing.
It was an extraordinary. There's an extraordinary situation going on in the Gulf at the moment. We talked earlier about the Women's British Open or the Women's Open Championship. In Boston at the moment, Dustin Johnson is the leader. Now, Dustin Johnson in the second round shot 60 and was 11 under through 11 holes in that 60.
He was
playing some of the most remarkable golf you'd ever want to see. Well, in the final round, he is currently 6 under through 8 holes. And he's going quite well. He's 28 under. 28 under.
He's taken a Mickey out of his course.
7 clear. Yeah, 7 clear of Harris English. He's already had an eagle on the second, and he's birdied 4 of the last 5 holes. So birdies on 4, 5, 7, and 8. And he's going very, very nicely. And he's actually got a birdie putt of about 7 feet to go what will be 7 under. In fact, he's just birdied it, has he? Yeah, he has. He's birdied it. So he's now 6 under.
He's 6 under through 8.
6 under through 8.
My data.
So he's got a 7-foot putt on the ninth to birdie it again. Another hole.
That'll be 7 under through 9.
Yeah. He's going very nicely, is Dustin Johnson. Now, when we were on air on Friday, Cameron Davis was going extremely well in that first round. He then continued to go very well in the second round. He went 64-65. Unfortunately, late in his third round, he had a triple bogey 6 on the par 3 16th. And it's sort of fair to say that it sort of halted his momentum. And shot a 72. Unfortunately, he is plus 1 through his final round to be 11 under and is now tied for 24th, equal with Cameron Smith as the leading Australian. So, unfortunate there for Cameron, who was playing so well on the first couple of days.
I want to get Danny Lee on this week, who is in the tie for third.
Danny Lee's your man.
I love Danny Lee, and he's a journeyman. He's a PGA Tour journeyman, New Zealander, who's a good fella. Seen him interviewed a few times. I want to get him on. He'd be good fun this week. He'd tie for third, be unbelievable result for him at the start of the FedEx Cup playoffs. So I would like to get a hold of him. And you mentioned Dustin 60 on Friday. Wasn't even the best score of the round. Scotty Scheffler shot 59, and no one's spoken about it because Dustin was 11 under through 11.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And it was a tap-in, too, to get to 59. The other thing I wanted to mention was with the Women's Open, I wonder if the RNA had their time again, whether they would have rescheduled the British Open for a little bit later on in the year with no crowds. Because, like Wimbledon, yeah, they made the call that there's no fans, there's no tournament.
Yep.
And watching the final round of the Women's Open, now I know that commercially it's not nearly as good for them to run it without the fans, but it didn't feel that abnormal watching it. Now I know that the women don't get as many fans than the men do, and all those sorts of things. But I just wonder if they had their time again, whether they would have done it, because golf's continued right through, and there's been a couple of positive take cases along the way and all that sort of thing, but they've managed it extremely well. I wonder whether they would have done it.
Well, the problem with that, Whitey, too, is the weather starts to creep in. Obviously.
Yeah.
How late are you talking?
I don't know, but, I mean, they play the event, what's that event called? The Dunhill Links Championship, where they play three different tournaments in Scotland, and that three different golf courses in Scotland, and that's done quite late in the year. I'm talking sort of October. I think they could have found a week if they wanted to. They're playing 7 weeks in a row in the UK at the moment, so on the European tour. But anyway, it was just a thought I had last night that, you know, you still got to watch the golf on the TV. There were still some people there, not paying participants, paying spectators. But, yeah, I reckon if they had their time again, they would have probably had it.
I don't know about that, Whitey, because it was the reason they pulled the pin early, like Wimbledon, was they had the pandemic insurance. So they've made their £250 million pounds or whatever it was. That was Wimbledon's number.
Fair, that's fair.
So I think because they had the buffer, the financial buffer, they would have very much considered taking that before worrying about fans and events.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Well, squillion bucks have got up their sleeve.
Yeah, there was also something quite significant in the world of cricket over the weekend in the UK with England playing Pakistan. Now, England in their first innings, 8 declared for 583.
That's a lot.
Pakistan 273 all out. But the significance was a debut, a maiden century, from a guy that we didn't really know too much about going into this series. He's been around for a little while. He plays at Kent, and his name is Mr. Crawley.
Zach
Crawley. He made 267 for England, batting at number three. Now, England have had real troubles, England, trying to find top-order players to protect Root, to keep Root batting at four rather than batting at three. You know, they haven't really been able to find openers to replace Alistair Cook. But Crawley, along with Butler, had this remarkable partnership, and it was 359. That's a big partnership.
That's a lot. There's a lot of runs between those two. Yeah, Zach's performance, 267 maiden century, is a good way to do it. Did you know, I found this out in the weekend, on the back of that information, that performance by Zach, that where do you think it ranks in terms of maiden centuries? Where do you think it ranks?
Highest, yeah. Number
in terms
four,
of highest.
I think.
Number seven. So there are six more maiden centuries that are higher than 267.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there's two that stand out. One is Sir Garfield Sobers. His first Test century was 365 not out. Yep. Second highest score of all time. Third highest score of all time or something. And then the other one was Brian Lara's 277 in Sydney was his first Test century.
Was it?
Yeah, it was.
I can tell you. I'll give you the order. Gary Sobers, 365 not out, was number one. Bob Simpson, 311, his first one. Who we got there? We've got KK Nair. Don't think I've come across.
Yeah, no, see,
that was only a couple of years ago.
That's a really interesting one. Yeah, I was going to say, that's a really interesting one. He made 300.
303,
and he couldn't stay in the team. He's had the team about two or three tests later.
Karun Nair.
Yeah, no, he's a good player. He gets on with the game. He's a bit of a sort of almost like a Sehwag type. But yeah, he couldn't keep his spot in the team because the team's so strong.
Well, he's got the third spot on the list. He's got Teddy Foster, 287. Brian Lara, 277 in fifth spot. Zahir Abbas, in 1971, made 274. And then we've got our man Zach. And Rowan Kanai is number eight now, with 260-something.
What cricket bat was Brian Lara using in his 277?
That's a very good question.
Oh, goodness.
Was it a Gray Nichols back then?
It was a, yes, it was, but which one?
No, I don't know which one it was.
Single scoop.
It was two. I've just brought that up on the screen. It was the single scoop. Good by you, Rama. That's the sort of stuff we're after.
Yeah, he went from the Gray Nichols to the Brian Lara 501 or the Brian Lara 375. I had a Brian Lara 501, or at least had the stickers. And then he went to MRF.
Hang on a second.
MRF.
What do you mean you had the stickers? Did you have the bat or not?
They actually weren't really... I don't think they actually were bats. You just put stickers on them.
They were bats. Which bat did you put the stickers on?
It was a Newbury, and I put the 501 stickers on them.
You're a disgrace. You are a disgrace.
Why the pads? Had
it's
the gloves.
Purely an image thing. Yes, that is purely an image thing. You're a disgrace. Robbie Griffiths, he is the president of the Australian Trainers Association. He's the main man at the Cranbourne Training Complex as well. And across the weekend, Friday, we learned that the Richard Lemming Stables had a staff member positive for coronavirus, which sent the whole industry into a bit of a panic, I would have thought. And the president of the ATA, I'm sure, would have got a few phone calls. Robbie, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Ha.
How was your weekend, Robbie?
I was a bit active on Friday night and Saturday morning, but we got through a busy weekend and created a big spin, but we got through quite well, which was fantastic.
So not only are you the president of the ATA, but you're also one of the long-time tenants there at the Cranbourne Complex. And when you hear the news or you get the information initially that there is a positive at Cranbourne, what was your immediate reaction?
Yeah, look, it was a major concern, naturally, first and foremost for the young lass of her health and well-being, and thankfully and hopefully she's going to be okay, which is the most important of all. And then, down to business, RV quickly with their tracing team wanted to lock down the stables, which was sort of notified and everyone read on the Racing Victoria website. And then with the tracing team, it was put into action to quickly round up a group of employees that needed to be tested. And then we got a fantastic CEO down here, Neil Bainbridge, and his team, Simon Hodson and co. And being president of the local group down here at Cranbourne, it was collectively thought of immediately to voluntarily... we weren't asked to lock down our training, but voluntarily, as a group at Cranbourne, we wanted to lock down our training the next morning so that we could increase our biosecurity measures and best practices in the best interest of making sure that we did everything in for the greater good of the bigger picture whilst we were, whilst RV were doing their tracing measures and we could go and do the hygiene and cleaning and biosecurity. And that coincided with all the testing results and so on, and thankfully they all come back negative. And everything was good to go, and we resume training today as per normal, and we can get back to normality. So we dodged the big bullet, and the industry can sort of carry on. So we were very fortunate.
So, Robbie, I mean, obviously there potentially were going to be massive ramifications because we've seen clusters grow very quickly. Were you worried on Friday, or were you confident that the systems, the protocols that have been set up by Racing Victoria were going to hold up in this situation? What was your initial feeling?
I think it's fair to say everyone would, you wouldn't be human if you didn't have concerns, but I had more confidence than I had a lot of confidence that we've had a lot of good things in place since March. I'm very proud of everyone in racing, all the trainers, the participants, the governance, everyone from RV, from politicians right through to RV, all the way through administrators right through the industry, have worked really hard to do our best to try to cover all avenues so that if something does pop up, we can we can pocket and isolate the problem and so that we can keep our industry moving forward. And so I had confidence that if something did come of a positive, we could isolate the situation and try and work through to a solution to keep our industry going. So that's what I was confident in being able to achieve. That was my personal belief. And I was really hoping, dearly, that the results come back really in our favour. And thankfully, they all come back negative. But if they had have come back not as good as we wanted to, I was still confident that, you know, there was enough good policies in place and practices in place that we could still isolate the situation so that we could, as an industry, we could sort of work towards keeping the greater industry going and isolate a situation. So that's what I was hoping for, and I think that everyone was hoping for the same. So I think that we do a lot of good things, and, you know, Friday showed that no industry, no workforce in all walks of life is, and, you know, can take anything for granted. It's a virus there that can pop up anywhere, and we've all got to work hard to take every day and don't take it for granted, and we certainly do not. And we just got to keep working towards it, you know.
James, good morning to you.
Thanks, Harf. Morning, everyone. This should be now known forever as Hutto Round 13. 13. Round 13.
Yes, it is round 13. It's almost finished too, Jim. It's almost finished. Not quite, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of almost finished, just digressing a touch. The Indy 500 is on at the moment. Did you know that? The Indy 500. And we're around about 160 laps into the 200 laps, so we're not too far off finishing, according to the live blog that I've just tapped into. But I digress a little bit. Ramo, there was a photo tweeted out by Timmy Hodges, our good mate.
Yeah.
Timmy Hodges last night, of an aerial view of the Indianapolis Speedway. And I saved it because I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing, that there is four holes of golf on the inside of the track at the Indianapolis Speedway. There's this beautiful aerial shot of this golf course on the top side of the photo anyway. There's 400,000 people in the venue, and there's four holes of golf on the inside of the track. It's quite remarkable.
Well, it looked amazing. So we'll get Joey to tweet that out on our handle, but that was absolutely amazing how that track looked with the 14 holes outside, the four holes inside. There's apparently a museum in the middle there somewhere as well, and it was just a beautiful photo, really.
Magnificent.
It used to be the case at Swan Hill that there was a golf course inside the racetrack at Swan Hill.
Is that right?
That is exactly right. It's not the case anymore, but it was the case. Hey, before we get to the footy, and I know we have to, but Curtis Luck is back leading
is he?
On the Corn Ferry Tour. So he's only got a couple of holes to play, and he is 11 under par, and there are 4 players at 10 under. Two of those have finished, and one of those is on the 17th, and one of those is on the 16th,
well,
along with Curtis.
Group.
So, yes, so it's up to him in a lot of ways. Probably be a bit unfair, but in a lot of ways it is up to him because he's got the lead with a couple of holes to play. So he did fall away from top spot, and he's been leading pretty much the whole way through after a first round sort of 68 and then following it up with a 66. So going into the weekend, he was in front. Can he hold on? We'll find out in the next sort of half hour or so.
Well, he's birdied 15 and 16. Yeah, he was two over after 14, and now he's even through 16. So that's got him back to the lead. And the other
birdied
guys
the last
on top.
Two.
Yeah, other guys at the top have had some incidents on the way in. So good luck, Curtis. See what I did there? Okay, let's get to the footy before I make any more bad jokes.
It's Monday at 7.
You're off. How good is that, Jim?
Yeah,
just because it's Monday doesn't mean you can't be sharp, Jim. You've got to be sharp on a Monday.
Nah, you're looking about sharp with your turtleneck on.
It's not a turtleneck. It's a warm.
It's a turtleneck.
What's it called? It's a puffer. No, it's not a puffer. It's a fluffy. Yeah. What do they call that stuff?
Polar fleece.
Polar fleece, that's what it is.
Yeah, very Cluedo-like you look, but keep going.
Jim, give me your number one takeaway from round 13 of the AFL to this point in time.
I think we have to probably discuss a bit of the Dogs' demons for me. And I know all of us like to say, who does it say more about? I know yes. we discussed that a bit, and I guess that was the question that I couldn't quite answer. So I thought, well, on Monday, let's turn to the brains that we have here in White, Ramanauskas and Harford. Who does it say more about? Because we're talking about the Dogs and their emphatic win against the Crows, whether that was a good sign that the Doggies were back and their midfield were, as Rama, you highlighted, completely dominant. As far as midfield groups dominating in opposition, I know the Crows are a naught and a thousand this year and don't look up to the standard. But when you have that such dominant performance, you've got to acknowledge it. So it showed to be good form for the Dogs. But does it say more about the Dogs with Aaron Norton, even though he was well held, but just at least having him part of the forward structure and their huge midfield? Or does it say more about the D's just failing again, sort of at a bit of a, you call it a litmus test?
Well, I always thought that was the Demons' form a bit of fake form. They beat North Melbourne, they beat Adelaide, then they beat a very depleted Collingwood. So it was the test that probably separated, I think, the two teams. And in the end, there's a bit of wind around on Saturday at Metricon Stadium, but the third quarter dominance of the Bulldogs was evident for all to see. They didn't get much out of Norton, or they didn't get much out of Bruce, but when they went inside forward 50, it was easy for them. Melbourne never really got going through the midfield through that whole game. Bruce was dominant in the ruck. Like, amazingly, the Bulldogs played Tim English as a permanent forward in the second half because they couldn't ruck him anymore because Bruce was so dominant in their game. So Josh Bruce was rucking. Josh Dunkley was in the ruck at some time. And then Tim English stayed forward. But I think in the second quarter, the Demons came out and gave a little bit Whitey. But other than that, Whitey, I thought the Bulldogs really controlled that game almost from start to finish.
I think, Jimmy, personally, it said more about Melbourne because the Dogs played at a level that you would expect when they've got their best team in. You know, their midfield is very strong, and at the moment, a lot of their midfielders are playing very well. But it showed Melbourne still has this issue around consistency of effort week in, week out, and within a game. So we saw samples of Melbourne playing really well, but it just seems, and again, I'm not the expert, but it just seems whenever you think Melbourne's clicked, they think they've clicked, and they drop away. They haven't got a sustained effort of effort. And I just feel they get ahead of themselves, both within a game, but also if you take a wider lens on their season.
Yeah. I was really disappointed, Jim, in the D's.
Can I just jump in there on the back of Whitey's point? I never sort of questioned Melbourne's effort because they constantly build their game around contested footy and clearances, but that's hard to sustain that pressure. And we saw that probably with, remember when the Saints just missed the eight probably 2 years ago, and it was all off the back of just energy, 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 energy. And you can't do that. Like, but not only you can't do it for four quarters because the opposition will come at you and you just can't sustain it, but you can't do it throughout an entire season, especially the season we've got where, you know, short backups and things like that. It's what is actually their layer of football off the back of the energy. The energy should be a given, you know, that contested football, outnumbering, defensive pressure. You should expect that, but it's what is the actual football away from that. And again, for me, it just, whether they address it with drafting, free agency or coaching, it's the polish and the system away and around those contested situations still for me, for Melbourne.
Well, that's what we highlighted in that third term, Rama. They're 7 points up at three-quarter at half-time, the D's. Now, they're going into the wind in the third quarter, but would have had it in the last. And at one stage, I think the way that the Bulldogs transitioned the ball from the back half, I mean, Crozier and Johannesson and Daniel in that third term did as they pleased, Rama. I think it was one stage, it was seven inside 50s for the Dogs in that third term, and they'd kick six goals. Like, it was just open up, just open the gate and said, there you go, boys, take all the space you like and we'll just let you run through. It was a very odd third quarter from the D's after having that lead at halftime, working so hard to get that lead, remember?
Well, the D's actually had more inside 50s for the quarter, but it was six goals, 1-3 behinds, I think, for the quarter. What Jim's talking about is around around that contest, Melbourne will never be never ever be questioned.
Yeah.
But then you look at uncontested football, Jim. It's plus 40 in the Dogs' favour. Melbourne just get themselves into tangles when the ball gets outside the contest because it's not one player running free. It's then the chain that the Bulldogs are able to create on the outside that has Melbourne just going scratching their head. I was watching that game on Saturday going, hang on, where's the Melbourne play here? The Melbourne player should have got across. The Melbourne player should have squeezed up. They shouldn't be able to move the ball. Like there was a real slow play through the Bulldogs backline. It was a simple one switch of the football, and then three Dogs players were out on the outer side of the ground. And I'm sitting there going, that can't happen. That's just the structure thing.
Yeah, so spot on, Rama. And the thing with it's 2 points that is. And we're both saying it, is Melbourne almost play contested footy, but then their structure is to play more contested football, whereas the Dogs, when they play their contested football, is to get those likes of Crozier, Johannesson, Daniel, the footy on the outside that you're touching on, get the ball into McRae, swinging out to his left. It's a system to allow you to play your game style. So, whereas at the moment... We 100% agree. Melbourne, they'll have a crack and they'll win contested footy, but what is it leading to? So all the opposition when they plan for Melbourne is we don't have to beat them, we just have to match it. Because if we just match them in that contested situation, our system outside of it is going to be better.
I think there's been an adjustment too from the Bulldogs with the way they move the ball.
So against the D's then, to everybody, are you better off setting up better behind the ball? Almost go, well, if we can break even at a contested with contested football with the D's, we're going okay. But if they kick it to us behind the football, we can then start move the ball on the outside and we're going to get the D's that way?
Yeah, well, I know in my time at Geelong, when you played sides like that, it was just so heavily contested focus. You still had to match them because of the territory battle and you don't want them to get their tails up. But you could sort of start to position... Your wing could just come a little bit off. Your half back can come a little bit more corridor because you know if you apply enough pressure at the source, you force that quick kick. You know, and you see the opposition defenders, they just start to wait for it. Like, that's all they want, it come in slow. But because they've got so many trapped, use the example, say it's on the half forward flank for Melbourne or near the logos, they then, you know, they scrap, they fight, they do that really well. They dump it in. This has always been the case with Melbourne. They'll get a lot of inside 50s, as we're talking about. But they'll dump them in, but then the rebound comes out to the open side. And if you did a freeze frame, you've got trapped of probably 12 Melbourne players all caught around near the logo on the opposite side of the ground. So the opposition then starts playing three quarters of the field with seven players. That is almost impossible to stop. That's why they get scored a lot against... They win the initial contest, turnover, rebound.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Doggies took full advantage of that. You look at their key players... McRae had 17 uncontested, Smith 17 uncontested, Hunter the same, Bontempelli 15, Johannesson 18. And that's what I think the Dogs have done a bit better in the last month or so. They've been able to get their good players on the outside and in space. And going forward, they've been a go-forward team in the last little while, as opposed to having heaps of touches in close, which is what they've been known for. Now they're expanding and getting forward. And they've got good players, Whitey, getting their hands on the footy going forward.
Lockie Hunter makes a massive difference to that. Half with the way he plays. Does. He's such a clever player. He uses the ball well, but even the shape that he creates with how he plays, I think he makes other players better as well. And I think, you know, he's obviously a very, very good player, but I think he makes a lot of difference out there.
But I did see this game as a battle for the position that both of these guys are on the ladder. Like, I don't see these guys being better because they're 1-11 versus top 8 sides for the year.
Yeah, I think the Bulldogs can be better still. I can see why you'd say that, but I think with Norton now back into the team, that straightens them up again. He will start to get a lot more one-on-one contest. Last week against the Crows, well, let's not worry about that. But even though Stephen may beat him on the weekend, He was still able to create contests at ground level. He was still able to create Mitch Wallace getting a lot of one-on-one contests himself. And Mitch Wallace is absolutely brilliant inside forward 50 as a one-on-one play. He kicks four on the weekend.
Loved it.
Whitey's right. They haven't had Lachie Hunter for a lot of the season. He comes back in now. He adds another difference. He adds more width to that team, the way he plays the game. I don't know. If the Bulldogs continue on this role, this type of form, they'll worry a couple of teams in September.
They're an interesting one, the Dogs, because they are 7-6 and they currently sit seventh on the table. They've got Geelong and West Coast in their next two. So based on where things are at, they kind of need to win at least one of those. They've got Hawthorn and Fremantle after that. So they've only got four games to go because they've also got the bye. So it's a little bit inflated where they sit on the ladder at the moment because they've played more games than some of the other teams. But if they're going to be a finalist, they've got to find a way to beat a team inside the top eight because they haven't really done that at any point this season. In fact, they haven't.
And that's a bit of my point. Where they sit on the ladder, I think, is sort of where they deserve at the moment. And waiting to see them perform well against one of these top sides. It's not necessarily the win I'm looking for. It's the performance against them. And look, to use the pun, I was bullish on the Bulldogs at the start of the year. I thought they were going to be maybe... I had them sitting fourth at the end of the home and away season because I thought they addressed a couple of their areas, whereas... bringing in Bruce and Keith, a key forward, key defender, because we know they've got midfield depth. And you have a look at that midfield, they are in that peak of their powers age bracket.
See, the gut feel on the Dogs half is that you look at them and they're in the eight, obviously, but I kind of feel like they're better than Collingwood and at least level with St Kilda, maybe better than St Kilda. And I reckon if they played Port Adelaide and Brisbane on neutral territory, there'd be a great chance as well. But they've lost to all of those teams through this season, and that's why they're teetering.
Yes, they are. All right, but they got the job done, the Dogs, in the weekend. The D's disappointing in that third term, and the Doggies took full toll, which is what good teams do. Let's move on to one of the games yesterday with Brisbane and St Kilda. Now, this was litmus tests before, Jim. This was a litmus test for the St Kilda Football Club, and they fell short by 2 points, but I don't think they lost any admirers with how they went about it, Jim. They worked really hard. In fact, they should have probably won in the last quarter. They dominated possession and opportunity in the last term, but just failed to hit the scoreboard after Jack Billings kicked that ripper from the pocket for the only goal of the quarter. What did you make of the Brisbane Lions and St Kilda clash?
Yeah, well, you guys know I'm a positive guy and I like to focus on the winners a lot, but I actually have come out with a bit more positives with the Saints and I have more concerns with the Lions. And I think we've touched on this a bit. We feel like they're one short everywhere and my worry is going to big finals. You look at all the good side. So I think we're pretty comfortable with Geelong, West Coast and Richmond as sort of being the premiership favourites. But you have a look at what they got forward of the ball. So big Tim Tam, Tommy Hawkins, West Coast. You got Darling, Allen, Kennedy, some other 10 kids they've got out of the waffle who can all play key forward. They've just got a huge list of them, the Eagles. And then Richmond, obviously, you've got Rewalt, Lynch and Martin. Now, it seems like Brisbane have got all mid-size flanker types in their forward line. So Eric Hipwood, even though we sort of put him as a tall forward, he's not a tall forward. He's a tall flanker, second, third forward because of his body shape and the way he gets the footy. And that's just still my concern with the Lions coming into a big finals. We saw it when they lost to the Giants. They just kept peppering away. They had no one really who could take a mark. So the Giants, the final series last year, they were able to just keep intercepting and hanging on. Unless their midfielders and small forwards just hit the scoreboard a lot, I have some concerns for them. And I still took that away from the Saints game.
Yeah, it's a good point because you look at Brisbane and you go, I'm not sure there's somebody there every week that can kick three goals.
Yeah.
Like you need a guy that you can go, yep, he's going to kick three or four. Charlie Cameron's probably the obvious one, but he's that small forward or smaller forward that you're talking about, Jim. So that consistency in scoring is a concern. But the inaccuracy now, what is it? Eight out of the last 11 games or something like that. They've they've kicked more behinds than points now. Yeah. I don't know. Is it mental? Is it technique? Is it, you know, it's probably a combination, but it's hurting them now. It really is.
Jimmy, I'm a bit like you with St Kilda. I mean, we know of St Kilda have been this free-flowing team that can score quite heavily and be really attacking and beat teams that way. But they actually matched it with Brisbane in the toughness stakes. And while Brisbane, yeah, they had missed opportunities and maybe they should have won by more, in a lot of ways, I have a bigger respect for St Kilda, even though they didn't win the game, based on their ability to play well differently, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whitey, just wait. So you expected Brisbane to be tougher than St Kilda?
Yeah, I thought Brisbane would win easily yesterday.
No, but I'm talking about easily. The toughness stakes. Do you think Brisbane is a tougher team than St Kilda?
I think Brisbane's one of the toughest teams in the competition to beat. You've got to play well to beat them. You've got to match them in the contest and all that sort of thing. I see St Kilda more as a team that can run and gun and hit the scoreboard and do it that way. I think they've improved as the year's gone along, but under Brett Ratten, they're a very different team to what they were when they were at their best under Alan Richardson, which is all about pressure.
Yeah, well, and I thought they should have won the game, as I mentioned before, that they had so many inside 50s in that last term, and they just lacked the poise, I think, Rama and Jim, that good teams would have found a way through the numbers in that forward half of the Saints in that last term, but they just kept hacking the ball back in to the hotspot, to the numbers, and it was all scrapped from there, and the Brisbane Lions were able to just own the ball every now and then and just stop play. But I thought Brisbane, under that pressure, Rama, which was probably the takeout for me, I must admit, under that pressure in the last term, they seemed to really second-guess themselves and question themselves about whether or not they could go to the other end and score. They refused to almost try. It was really safe and negative. Yeah. And I know they had the lead and they were trying to save it, but they didn't move the ball with any fluency or aggression at all in that last term. And I thought, gee, they put themselves under pressure on the back of it.
So Brisbane needed to score, obviously, and they weren't really trying to. There was a contest on centre wing where Zach Bailey probably won the game for Brisbane, where he's able to win it. Ball goes down the other end. They're able to lock the ball. But just that point that you make, and Jim, this is the interesting part. When teams are chasing late in games, and St Kilda were chasing hard, obviously, that hack kick that you talk about, that's where you need players with a lot of composure.
Yep.
Because a number of times around that 50 to 70 mark, you just saw just players just jamming it on the boot. You know, Harris Andrews coming across, Darcy Gardner coming across Smoyley. Jared Berry had put himself back into the dangerous spot. He's coming across to the spoiling. What St Kilda actually needed to do, and this is the hard part, because you don't have your runner coming out. So you don't have your runner in your ear saying, there's 3 minutes to go, there's 2 minutes to go. You know, you because you're in that mindset, I've just got to get the ball in because the siren's going to go, you lose the composure. So what St Kilda actually needed to do is they needed to take the ball from side to side from their 50 to try to shift Brisbane's defenders from side to side to pick a hole. But because they had no idea of the time on the clock, which is a great thing, mind you, they just kept just jamming in there high, and it was too easy, really, for the Brisbane defenders.
The super coach from Western United, Mark Rudin, who has led his team into a chance to win a semi-final to get into the A-League Grand Final in their first year of existence. It's a great story in Australian sport. There's been a lot happening in Australian sport, but this one has been undersold, this effort, I reckon, and the coach has been good enough to join us. Mark, congratulations.
Thanks, guys. Good morning to you guys as well. Yeah, I heard the intro. Really, really happy with last night, obviously, and you know, really proud of everybody. Tough game, very physical, but we, you know, live another day, and we've got another game now on Wednesday. We've got to back up pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, it's Melbourne City on Wednesday, which is great. Crosstown rivalry, it's good fun to have that sort of stuff in an A-League's finals campaign. But the performance on it last night, I mean, 21 minutes in, your score, Alessandro Diamante scores, and he's a class act. He's got brilliance written all over him, Diamante, if you've seen him play. Obviously, you have, but for our listeners, he's something else. How did the game change in that moment? What did you do differently than perhaps you planned to do after that moment?
Oh, the plan was no different. You know, we wanted to, you know, we are a good side, of, you know, and scoring first does help us. So we've got a real mental edge about us as well. We, you know, there are question marks throughout the season, and it's been a tough season. But, you know, when we've gone behind, we've been able to come back and win a game. When we've led, we've been able to hold out against Western Sydney Wanderers. We're up 3-0, and they got back to 3-3. And, you know, probably what I was most proud of was, you know, that guts and the determination that the players showed. They, you know, they didn't shirk a tackle. They didn't shirk the responsibility. They, you know, they stayed very disciplined in their defensive structure when it would have been easier to do whatever they wanted to do. We talked about being selfless as well. And, you know, in these finals games, you've got to minimise mistakes and, you know, and you've got to just get through to win a game. And that's what they did. And we still created chances thereafter. And that's what was pleasing as well.
Yeah, you did that, and you looked threatening all night long. You mentioned it was a physical game. It was good to watch, actually, I must admit, from an Aussie Rules background, to see the level of physicality that was on show last night. I got a bit of a kick out of that. And we've talked through the weekend, Mark, about the Indigenous players in the AFL and how their natural flair is sometimes something you just guide as a coach as opposed to really coach it. And with a guy like Don Monty, what do you do with him? How do you guide or coach him?
Yeah, good question. You know, he's someone that you've got to unlock and unleash. You can't really chain him up. You know, I think it's important that he's not someone that enjoys the art of defending, I guess, but, you know, he still has to do it, right? So, you know, that's being selfless, and that's doing your bit for the team as well. And, you know, he was really good in that department, in that area. We know what he can do when we're in possession of the ball, and that's where he comes to the fore. But at the same time, you know, you can't stop these guys doing what they do best. I mean, we're very, very tough in terms of our positional play and the tactics and exactly what the kind of runs and movements we're after. But in the final third, you might have, you know, A, B and C, but, you know, with Diamante, you know, there's that X factor, and you know, you just tell the guys, particularly in the front third, you know, do what comes naturally. You know, with Bess Arisho, who's exactly the same as well. You know, you just got to allow these guys to do what comes naturally. And these guys, their game's based around instinct as well. So when Diamante's got the ball, if he wants to dribble three, so be it. As long as he doesn't lose the ball, right? But you know, same with Bess as well. But you know, I enjoy watching people like Diamante play. Not just coach, but I enjoy watching him play. You know, I'm like a fan as well. I'm no different. And he's just a joy to watch and a joy to coach as well.
Mark, I know it is what it is with the semi-final being on Wednesday, but ideally, would you like a couple of more days, or do you just feel like you've got the momentum and Wednesday can't come quick enough now?
Oh, look, the medical staff will tell you from a recovery point of view, they'd love an extra day. I mean, that goes without saying, I guess. But, you know, momentum is a wonderful thing. The collective spirit that we've got right now, and, you know, those that have played the game will tell you finals football is just as much based on adrenaline as everything else. I mean, we're very smart in terms of the way we'll recover these plays. And so are the players. They were straight to bed last night. They understand how important sleep is to recovery. But, you know, it won't be easy. You know, it won't be easy, not just based on, you know, the recovery time, but Melbourne City is going to be a fantastic opponent. You know, we haven't beaten them this year, and we want to get one over them, and no better time to do that in finals. But, you know, I think the players, you know, when you talk to them about being one game away from the big dance, I think there's not too much there you need to motivate them on. And in terms of their own recovery, they'll be very good at that.
And you don't have to go back too far to work out what happened or how you have to play Melbourne City. It was last Wednesday you played them in the last home and away game and they beat you 3-1. How much do you go back and study that tape or do you take momentum with you and just keep rolling with what you've done on the week or yesterday?
Yeah, look, I made 8 changes for that game and we put a lot of young players in that needed the minutes. You know, we had a crucial, a real tough go at it. You know, we had 6 games to play. We weren't able to play post-COVID for the first 14 days. We were in quarantine in New South Wales. So, you know, a week earlier, we qualified for the final. The 2 games after that, we just managed the players.
Yep.
Those that we thought were going to start last night, and I thought we did that well. So there's nothing to take out of that Melbourne City game as far as we're concerned. It'll be good to play them for the first time this year at full strength. You know, all 3 times we've had different teams. playing against them for different reasons. It'll be good to have a crack at them when we're at full strength. And right now, you know, that the word is that all the players have pulled up really well. Yeah, a few, you know, bruises and things like that because it was a physical game last night, but nothing these guys can't get over and overcome, I guess. But, yeah, we're looking forward to Wednesday. Can't wait. And like I said, we just want to continue on this ride. And, you know, we're riding a big wave at the moment and we don't want to get off it, right? And you know, it's just a wonderful feeling to be part of this special group.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.